This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Before there was Edward Snowden, there was the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI. The group of Philadelphia-based activists were concerned about surveillance, infiltration, and the possible abuse of power by the Bureau and its powerful leader, J. Edgar Hoover. They broke into the FBI offices in media more than 40 years ago in March 1971. They stole hundreds of pages of documents and mailed them anonymously to several newspaper reporters and some members of Congress. They revealed dirty tricks that led eventually to a congressional investigation and a series of reforms. The FBI spent years trying to identify the burglars, but to no avail. Our guest, Betty Metzger, who received these stolen documents, was a reporter at the Washington Post and has identified most of the activists in her new book, The Burglary, and she joins us on Radio Times. Betty Metzger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. And two of the burglars, if I can call them, join us in our studio here, John and Bonnie Raines, who live here in Philadelphia. Bonnie Raines, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And John Raines, nice to have you with us
as
well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with you, Bonnie. Has it been hard to keep this secret for more than 40 years?
Not really. We agreed that once we delivered the documents and hoped to see the outcome that we wanted to see, that we would just return to our regular lives, and we were not going to talk about it with anyone whatsoever.
I assume you talked about it with each other.
Well, we stayed up a few nights about it.
Especially the first 5 years.
And why the first 5 years? Well, in part because you were being investigated, or
yes,
the FBI was looking for you.
200 agents were looking for us.
And did you tell your children? Did your children know, Bonnie?
Well, our older two children were old enough to. Much of the planning was done at our home in Germantown in a room on the third floor. And so our older children knew that we had guests in the house and that there was a lot of activity around a plan, but they didn't really know specifically what was going on. When our children then we have four children, once they were old enough to understand it, we told them, because it was really a significant chapter in our family history.
Well, I do want to talk about that chapter, but Betty, let me get you in on the conversation. You received some of these stolen documents. What was your first reaction?
Well, my first reaction was surprise and a little bit of shock. That's because the first file that I read was one that was a policy statement that one could hardly believe. It was a statement that said agents should enhance paranoia, and also that agents should make it appear that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. I thought that was a pretty extreme statement.
And these were statements from the FBI, part of these documents that you then read through and used as some of your reporting for the Washington Post at the time.
Right. The burglars sent out the files, a new set of files, every 10 days to 2 weeks for a period of about 2 months.
And was there any hesitation at the Washington Post, because you didn't know who was sending them to you, was there any hesitation about publishing some of this material?
There was. What happened was the main concern when I finished reading the documents, it was clear that this was important information that the public needed to know, and the editors at the Post agreed with that. And we fortunately had confirmation from the Attorney General, John Mitchell, within a very short period of time that the documents were authentic, were ones that had, copies of ones that had been stolen from the media office. And then he spent the afternoon calling two of the editors plus publisher Catherine Graham, demanding that they not publish. Mm. The House counsel also advised that. But fortunately, by 10 o'clock that night, Catherine Graham made the decision to publish, and the stories ran. The story ran in the Post the next day, and the same story, by the way, on the front of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was the first time that a journalist had received secret government documents from a source outside government, as opposed to an inside whistleblower who had stolen the files. So that was a cause for pause. It was also the first time that the Nixon administration demanded that Katharine Graham suppress a story.
But she didn't, obviously.
She did not, and she had much practice later on.
Yes, indeed. It kind of set the stage for what was to come. Let me go back to you, John and Bonnie Raines, and even talk about Philadelphia at the time. We're talking about late 60s, early 70s. I would say I describe you as activist. Bonnie, would that be a pretty apt description of you at the time?
Oh, yes. Beginning with the civil rights movement. John, in particular, was a freedom rider and civil rights activist. Then when we moved to Philadelphia, we found a whole community of activists here that we affiliated with, and our first real action was with a group of people who were resisting the draft, the so-called Catholic left, and we participated in a draft board raid where we went in the middle of the night and removed draft files and destroyed them.
Mm. Were you, and I'm curious about whether you, John, and others, part of this group, did you know that the FBI was surveilling you? Was it about suspicions that there was surveillance going on?
Well, my experience with the FBI, and I always say J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, because that's very important to realize that J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI for almost five decades. He was the most powerful man in Washington. He was more powerful than presidents. They come at 4 or 8 years. And he was able to mold that large institution according to his own biases. So that my first experience of J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI was really down south in the civil rights movement. I was a freedom rider in 1961, part of Mississippi Freedom Summer in 64, and was on the Selma March in 65. And it was very clear for those of us involved in the civil rights movement that J. Edgar Hoover wanted to suppress that movement. He wanted the streets quiet. He wanted the protest ended. And he used all of his power to try to do that. Luckily, of course, he failed, and freedom won. Now, we brought that kind of experience north into the anti-war movement. And it was clear to those of us in that war movement, anti-war movement, that there were literally hundreds of FBI agents taking pictures of us everywhere, listening to our telephones, sandbagging our mail and so on. But we had no evidence. Mm-hmm. We only had our experience, and that's led us to what we did.
Do you think, Bonnie, that
that had gone on for a half century?
Yeah, go ahead, Betty. I was going to get you in on the conversation. Put that into some context for us.
Yeah, I mean, that FBI that John accurately refers to as J. Edgar Hoover's FBI started in 1924 when Hoover was 29 years old. And so by the time they burglarized the media office in 1971 and opened the door, literally, not only to that office, but then opened the door to the FBI generally, that kind of activity, political spying and dirty tricks operations, had been going on for a half century.
Let me turn to you, Bonnie, because I know one of the things that you did, I guess, in anticipation of breaking into the FBI office and media was to go there, I guess, posing as a young person interested in what, employment perhaps at this office or opportunities for young women?
Well, we had gathered all the information called casing up to that point about the outside of the building and the activities in and out of the building. But we needed to get inside the office during business hours to learn about the layout of the office. And so I was recruited to pose as a Swarthmore College student and ask for an interview because I said I was doing research on opportunities for women in the FBI. And they gave me a time for an interview, and I disguised my appearance as best I could. And went in and had enough time, maybe 45 minutes, to really scope out the entire office and to see that there were no security systems whatsoever. The file cabinets were not locked. So that gave us the information that we really needed to move ahead.
John, had you ever burgled an office or a building or an apartment or anything in your past?
Oh, yes. We were both members, Bonnie and I were both members of the East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives. That was the Berrigan Brothers group. And we learned our burglary skills from priests and nuns, who turned out to be very good teachers.
And you're not being sarcastic here.
No, I'm not. This is literal truth, yeah.
But did you have hesitation? I mean, there must have been some hesitation, because you were breaking the law.
Well, there was a lot of hesitation. Mostly because we're parents at the time. We had three children under 10. And so that that gave us a very considerable kind of thoughtful pause before we committed to the burglary. We were pretty confident in our burglary skills. We had done the casing, as Bonnie indicated, very carefully. Bonnie had gone in and discovered that there was no internal security and that the doors were fairly simple to get into. Still, as the time for the burglary approached, I, more than Bonnie, curiously enough, began to be very worried.
Because of your children?
Because of my children, and because I knew that J. Edgar Hoover would throw everything he had at us. And he had a lot. I mean, he had 200 agents put on our case, and they flooded the Philadelphia area. Lucky for us, the Philadelphia area was the national center back then, in the late 60s, early 70s, of the anti-war movement. There were literally thousands of activists opposing that war here in this area. Mm. There was a whole ocean, so to speak, with many, many fish in it. And we could, after the robbery, we could disappear in and meld in with all those fish.
Were you less worried, Bonnie, because what, you were confident it would happen, or you just you put this out of your mind?
Well, I had a great deal of confidence in our leader, Bill Davidon, who was a very smart, strategic, careful person. We took all the necessary steps to be prepared for any contingency. And we were a group of, it was a tight-knit group of people with common values, and we were very committed and careful. So I was quite confident. I don't think cocky exactly, but confident.
but Betty, about a minute before our first break here, but it seems to me that this group was taking a great risk. They may have felt confident, but still a great risk in breaking into the FBI office.
It was an enormous risk. Bill Davidon had become the leader of the group and was very well known in the Philadelphia peace movement, had become convinced by late 1970 that if the government was suppressing dissent, which he by then thought it was, he thought that's a crime against democracy, and it's a crime that has to be stopped. And it was that kind of commitment that they had, that this was, if dissent was so precious, that if it was occurring, it was important enough to risk your freedom for many years. So that's an extraordinary kind of commitment.
And that's Betty Metzger. She's the author of a new book called The Burglary. One of the reporters who anonymously received FBI files covered those stories based on those files for the Washington Post. Former chair of the Department of Journalism at San Francisco State University, founder of its Center for Integration and Improvement of Journalism. She joins us along with John and Bonnie Raines, and they were part of a group of Philadelphia activists that broke into the FBI's media office in March 1971, active in the civil rights and anti-war movement, and those documents led to a congressional investigation and to some reforms as well. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-553-7100. That's 215-553-7100. Drexel supports WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, Ben Stiller isn't a daredevil, but that's really him skateboarding down a mountain in his new movie.
But then I was basically pulled up off the skateboard, and I was like dangling from this arm like a marionette going 40 miles
an hour. I want to see those scenes.
I have them. They're going to be on the DVD and the outtakes.
Ben Stiller and the Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now. Thousands of protesters in Thailand jammed the streets in the capital of Bangkok. They want to oust the current government and replace it with an unelected People's Council. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about an incident that happened on March 8, 1971. Philadelphians Bonnie and John Raines were two of eight people who broke into the FBI's Media Pennsylvania office, stole files about the Bureau's surveillance program. John Raines spent many years at Temple University, both as a professor of religion and chairman of the department. He's now an adjunct professor there. Bonnie Raines founded two Philadelphia child care centers here in Philadelphia and was a policy associate with what is now known as the Public Citizens for Children and Youth. And they were all members of this group of local activists that broke into this office. Also with us, Betty Metzger is the author of a book called The Burglary about what these activists did. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bonnie, let me go back to you. I mean, do you feel like there was nothing else you could have done besides break into this office?
That's how we felt. There really was. It began to feel like it was a citizen's responsibility to stand up to Hoover and to reveal important threats to democracy. And we felt we were entitled to do that because we were citizens who were concerned about his threats and his methods.
And what did it take, John, to get inside this office? I know there was some plans to get in that were derailed a bit. It was a little more secure getting in the door than you thought it was going to be.
Yes. Well, one of us, Keith Forsyth, had practiced to become a locksmith. And he was the person who was going to pick the lock on the main door and get us in. Unfortunately, when he got there, the lock was a very sophisticated lock, more sophisticated than he had thought. And he could not get into that door. Bonnie had discovered when she was inside that there was a second door, but in front of that door there was a very large metal cabinet. And so what had to happen was when Keith couldn't open the first door, he phoned back to Bill Davidan and others. We were in a motel center at Granite Mill Mall. And Bill was very firm here, and this is the leadership that he had. He said, "Well, let's try the other door," and sure enough, Keith could get the second door open, but there was a dead bolt, and he had to use a crowbar. Wow. Now, luckily, it was during the fight. Ali and Fraser were on the radio, and the fight was going on, and so any noise that came from the office. For the people upstairs, the apartment people, or the super whose apartment was directly below the FBI office, they were distracted.
Well, and did you choose a date knowing that there would be this big fight,
yes.
Muhammad Ali and,
yes.
and Joe Frazier? Yes,
mm-hmm.
Bonnie, you say?
Yes, we did. We also thought that the police might be a little distracted and perhaps a little more lax in their patrols mm-hmm. because they would be listening to the fight as well.
And, I mean, I'm assuming that this was an office full of documents. Did you know what you were looking for, Bonnie?
We had a pretty strong hunch that we would find something concrete. Because the FBI is such a bureaucracy, everything goes into their written records. But it was a hunch, and we really didn't know for sure until we removed all the documents and then had a chance to sort through them to see what we had.
And was there one, were there ones that you just felt like, this is what we're looking for?
It didn't take very long
really?
To find what Keith referred to as the gold, the gold in the documents, and a very, very clear language about illegal surveillance.
And did you know, you knew it was illegal at the time?
Yes, we did. So definitely First Amendment material.
Betty, let me go back to you. And as you have referenced earlier in the interview, you received this packet of documents from this anonymous citizens organization.
The Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. That's what the burglars named themselves. And that's exactly what they did in a far deeper ways than they probably thought possible both for themselves right. and then what they made possible for others to do later.
And why you, Betty?
Well, better to ask them that. I had no idea since I didn't know who they were at the time.
So why Betty Metzger died?
Well, Betty had been here in Philadelphia. She was a religion editor for the Bulletin when that paper was still in publication. And from those days, we knew her. We knew that she'd gone down to the Washington Post, where she was the religion editor there. So she was one of the five that we sent these documents to. As it turned out, the Washington Post was the only one of the five that, in fact, decided to publish these. The New York Times did not publish it. The L.A. Times, so Los Angeles Times, did not publish. The two progressive political persons that we sent them to immediately turned all of those files back to the FBI.
And we should say one of them was Senator George McGovern.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
And the other, Representative Perrin Mitchell from Baltimore.
That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised that they gave the information back to the FBI?
I was.
Dismayed, I think, would be a better way to say it. We thought better of them.
Betty, you have a pretty interesting story because for years you did not know who this group was, and you were, it sounds like you were having dinner at our guest house a couple of years ago, and you realized these were the people that had sent you these documents.
Yeah, well, John blurted out a comment that made it pretty clear.
without thinking about
without,
it.
Oh, really? You just, okay.
I was in California, and I was visiting Philadelphia and seeing people who were acquaintances from the years when I worked there, and I spent the first evening at dinner with John and Bonnie. And when their daughter, whom I had never met, came into the room, John suggested that they'd like for her to know me better because many years ago when they had information about the FBI that they thought the American public should know, they gave it to me. Hmm. And I was astonished.
You had no idea.
I never had any idea. I never tried to find out, not that I think I could have, but from the beginning, once I knew those documents were authentic, my emphasis entirely was on the substance of them, which I thought was very important, rather than who had stolen them. So I had no idea, but I was very interested in learning once they told me.
Well, having read your book, you do name, obviously, our guests here and some other people, but not everyone, I guess, who was part of this group of eight. Is that right, Betty?
Right. There were eight, and with the help of John and Bonnie and others, we found seven of the eight. And two of the seven, although they were interviewed extensively and participated a lot, have chosen for personal reasons not to be named. We should also say that there was a ninth burglar who shortly before the burglary dropped out. And when you talk about the risk that they all took, this is another important element. He knew everything about their plans and could have informed on them in advance. They had no idea whether he would. And, in fact, he came to visit John and Bonnie just a couple of weeks after the burglary and threatened to turn them in.
Yes.
Yes, you say, John.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a very close call. He had a girlfriend, and he was very well known in this area as this person I'm talking about, as an activist against the war. And he was, I think, his girlfriend, I'm persuaded, was an FBI agent, or at least was acting at the FBI. She told him, he said to me, that there were files there that we hadn't yet released that were very dangerous for national security, that there were pinpointing anti-missile silos in and around Philadelphia and so on. And, of course, that was nonsense. There were no such files. And I told him that. And he left, and boy, we had our fingers crossed because he could have blown the whistle, and that would have been the end of it.
Well, Bonnie, let me go back to you, and just I want our listeners to understand once this went public and Betty Metzger and the Washington Post began publishing some of these stories, the FBI really, it sounds like they just swarmed into the Philadelphia area looking for you and your co-conspirators, if I can use that.
Yes, they did swarm, 200 of them, and the story is that Hoover yelled at his agents, "Find me that woman," because they figured out that the connection. And so mine was the only face that they knew. And so there was a sketch of me that was being circulated, apparently. But we never, we just, as we said before, there were so many other possible suspects, and they kept sort of barking up the wrong trees in terms of others who'd gone into other draft boards or some of those other activities. So that was important in terms of our not being caught.
And the statute of limitations was, what, 5 years?
5 years, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So after 5 years, you...
We relaxed a little bit.
Well, let me reintroduce everybody, and that's Bonnie Raines, who joins us along with John Raines, and they were part of a group of people that broke into the FBI's Media Pennsylvania office on March 8th, 1971, gave many of the documents to a number of newspapers, including the Washington Post, also two members of Congress. Betty Metzger writes about what happened when both they broke into this office, and also what happened to that information. Her book is called The Burglary. John and Bonnie Raines live here in Philadelphia. John Raines is now an adjunct professor at Temple University, where he was chairman of the religion department. And Bonnie Raines spent many years in Philadelphia working on child care issues. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Betty, let me just go back to you and helping us again understand the level of surveillance and infiltration that was happening here in Philadelphia, the number of people that were being targeted, the kinds of people that were being targeted by the FBI, just how, I guess, pervasive or extensive was all that?
It was very pervasive. The media files revealed important national programs like COINTELPRO and the Security Index, a list of people that Hoover planned to arrest without access to habeas corpus in the event of a national emergency. But the revelations about Philadelphia were great. They revealed that in some of the campus communities, there were networks of FBI informers that included switchboard operators, postal carriers, security guards, and in some cases, members of campus administrations. But the largest surveillance that the documents provide evidence of is what was happening in the black community of Philadelphia. And it literally was a blanket surveillance of the entire black community, almost impossible to imagine. But the prescription for where surveillance should take place came right down to the every institution or every place that a person might go, the corner store in their neighborhood, their church, their classrooms, their libraries, their bars, their restaurants. There were informers in all of those places. It was just impossible for a black person to go anywhere and be sure that there wasn't an informer.
Betty, did the federal government know anything about COINTELPRO? I mean, the extent of the kind of surveillance and infiltration that was happening under the aegis of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI?
Did you say did the federal government know?
Yes, like Congress.
Hoover kept most of these elements of his programming, and especially COINTELPRO, secret within the bureau. And they weren't even known to attorney generals, who technically were his bosses, but few, if any, were. Robert Kennedy tried, and presidents, most presidents didn't know either.
Was the goal, and I'll look at you, John Raines, and then I do want to get to some of our callers. Was the goal then to shed light on what the FBI was doing, to bring in some kind of reforms and controls over this agency?
Of course. The problem was nobody in Washington that had an official position was going to do this. Nobody was going to hold J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI accountable. And we faced a situation where you had an out-of-control, very powerful man, an out-of-control, very powerful institution in Washington that Washington would not bring within control, would not make responsible. So it was left to we, the citizens. I mean, mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that We're the last line of defense. The average citizen is the last line of defense when it comes to freedom, and that will be true until the end of our nation.
Mm. It's interesting to have this conversation, Betty, while, Bonnie, while the whole Edward Snowden story unfolds. Do you see connections there?
Oh, I see a parallel, of course, and so do a lot of other people now. It's a tradition of whistleblowers that I think are important at certain times in our society, in our democracy. And I think he has performed a very fine service. He's not put anyone at risk as far as we know, and has had considerable sacrifice in his own life because he has done that.
Do you see parallels, Betty?
Yes, I do. His stated purpose is almost precisely their stated purpose. To bring evidence to the American public about the vast surveillance that is taking place, with the idea that then the public can take it from there if they choose to do so, and they certainly did after the media burglary and after COINTELPRO became revealed and Congress took steps. It's a little different now.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how it's going to finally end up. But Congress now I haven't heard suggestions of an investigation taking place, which is what took place then before reforms were suggested.
Well, and we've done a number of shows about Snowden and the NSA. What's interesting, Betty, is that the NSA, as we understand it today, is basically data mining everybody, and what we're
all over the world,
and what we're talking about with the Rains and what was happening back in the 1960s and 70s, and I guess even before that, was targeting individual people or individual organizations.
Well, what was happening then was felt in people's guts, I think, more, because there were those individual stories. Although, like I said about the black community, that was a blanket kind of surveillance, though low-tech compared to what's happening now. I think it's important to look now, though, that, yes, it's true that the surveillance is everybody, but then it is possible within that surveillance to target in deeper ways any individual, so that if the government wants to, and it has wanted to in the case of us Muslims, it can target in on individuals. But I think the fact that it's so high-tech that it's less noticeable than it was then when our organizations were filled with informers.
And we're almost up in a break here. What was the initial response to the articles that you began to publish in the Post, Betty?
Almost instantly, there were calls in Congress for an investigation of the FBI and of J. Edgar Hoover. It also was very interesting what happened in newspapers. Editorial writers were also issuing those calls for investigations. And part of the significance of that is that Hoover had been such an icon that he never was criticized in the press. It was just extremely rare, and including in the Philadelphia newspapers. And that changed almost instantly. I remember the Inquirer running quite strong editorials and columns, and one in particular that said, you know, what a shame it is that the only way Americans have been able to learn in over a half century what their FBI is doing is by having burglars present them with information.
We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the music of Tchaikovsky, the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The January Tchaikovsky Festival continues as the orchestra's Haye Ni performs the Rococo Variations, and Christian Macellaro conducts the Serenade for Strings. Tchaikovsky Festival tickets at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the music of Tchaikovsky with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Computer hackers recently stole the information of more than a third of all Americans from retail giant Target. On the next Fresh Air, we talk personal and global cybersecurity with P.W. Singer. His new book is called Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new album, High Hopes. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The genius of established big companies breeding the next innovators?
Corporate innovation is when you think really big about a problem that's adjacent to your space. Address that problem in a way that's good for the customers and good for yourself.
Entrepreneur Chunka Moy believes the old big Fortune 500 may be the source of the next big thing in business. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. Just a quick recap here. On March 8, 1971, eight activists broke into the offices of the FBI in Media, Pennsylvania, and that's a suburb of Philadelphia. They stole files about the Bureau's surveillance of members of anti-war and civil rights groups. They sent those documents to a number of newspapers and to two members of Congress, including, I should say, to the Washington Post. The Post published stories based on these documents, shedding light on the FBI's secret program. That led eventually to congressional hearings and to reforms. And until recently, the identities of the burglars have been a well-kept secret. Betty Metzger, our guest who wrote about those Washington Post stories, reveals their name and tells this story in her new book called The Burglary. She joins us along with two of the burglars, John and Bonnie Raines, who live here in Philadelphia. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jonah from South Philadelphia to join us. Jonah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty. Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm calling because this burglary has sort of been a dining room table story in my family since as early as I can remember. My dad, Robert Eaton, was a sophomore student involved in the civil rights movement, so he had a pretty hefty FBI file, which got scooped up along with many others in the burglary. And then my mother at the time was working up at an anti-war outfit in Boston. And I don't know if Mr. and Mrs. Raines sent that material on. They basically received a full copy of everything, and they were distributing it to various journalists. And so before my parents had ever met, my mother read my dad's entire FBI file.
Well, that's interesting.
I'd share that story.
And your last name is, their last name, Jonah, is Eaton?
Eaton, yeah.
Eaton.
Yeah. Me and my dad were both on... You interviewed us a couple months back about our boat project. Totally unrelated.
But. Oh, I got you. Okay, small world here. Well, I appreciate Jonah the call to Radio Times. Were there others, John Raines, that had access to these documents?
Well, once we got them photocopied and sent to the people we hoped would get them going public, once it went public with the Washington Post, with Betty's work. Then there were other groups here in Philadelphia that were very active in distributing those files and sending them all over the country. And in fact, there was a FBI fair in Mantua, Powhatan Village.
Powhatan, yeah, in Philly.
And here in Philly, and you could buy, you could purchase the files. You could have your picture taken with an arm around J. Edgar Hoover. And... Philadelphia, especially around the universities, were just flooded with these FBI agents. So what the folks did in Powhatan Village is wonderful. They bought these little air horns. And you could always tell an FBI agent that they drove the same car, they had the same short haircut and so forth.
They probably looked a little different from the two of you.
Yeah, right, exactly. So all over, all day, all night, all over Powhatan Village here, beep, 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 beep. So the attempt of J. Edgar Hoover to intimidate the anti-war dissenters and resistors backfired. Mm-hmm. It did just the opposite. It gave them new energy.
How close, Bonnie, did they get, you think, to identifying you, especially since they had a drawing of you?
I don't believe very close, although there was one close call when two agents came to our house and to interview John, and he spent a little time talking with them, although not finally answering any of their questions. And sort of threw them off track, and they then left without accomplishing what they wanted to. And 10 minutes later, I came back from work and walked in the house. so I have no idea whether they would have recognized me because, of course, in the sketch, I looked different than I would look every day. But so I don't have the feeling that they really did get close.
I'd like to add.
Yeah, go ahead, Betty.
For from reading the 34,000-page investigation of the case, I know that 2 weeks after that visit by the FBI to John and Bonnie's house, John was removed as a suspect in the case.
So, oh, my. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
So you're a good liar? Is that what we know about you, John Reeds?
But I didn't know it at the time. Betty found out years later.
Much later.
Much later. Let me get, looks like Matt from media to join our conversation. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good.
I vividly remember this. I grew up within a block from where this burglary took place. I was a bulletin newspaper boy, and that building was on my newspaper route. And, you know, the FBI came to our neighborhood after the burglary and was walking around and showing pictures. And it changed me that day that I saw those pictures. I was pretty much, my dad was an Archie Bunker, a World War II kind of guy, and thought the protesters were anti-American. And, you know, I kind of went along with that. When I saw the pictures taken so surreptitiously of people eating lunch and just at rallies, and I knew they weren't mugshots, something changed in me. At that point, you know, I felt that this is what I thought we were fighting in Vietnam for, to defeat communism and the secret police. And here we got our own citizens being spied on, right, wrong, or otherwise. And at that point, you know, my whole attitude changed towards, you know, our government's involvement in the war. And, you know, it did more for me seeing those pictures than anything that they sent to newspapers. I mean, I was only 13 years old at the time.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let me give
I vividly remember that.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'd be curious about your response, Bonnie.
It's an interesting response, and it is the notion that it borders on a secret police force that I think made a lot of people, including this caller, wake up to how dangerous this is in our so-called free society of democracy.
Well, and Betty too. I mean, as you described them, these were not, you know, wild-looking, you know, activists, counterculture types. These were regular, normal-looking people. Do I have that right?
Yes, definitely.
And I'm looking at them right here, but yes.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to say one of the powerful impacts of this is that it continues. One of the things that happened was the strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act in 1974 as a result of some of the revelations. And that, in the end, may have been the most powerful impact, because that meant that for the first time, the public had access to FBI files. And as a result, journalists and scholars, as well as some average citizens, have been writing about the true history of the FBI. Many books, many articles have been written as a result of the opening of those files.
Let me get, it looks like Larry from Allentown to join our conversation. Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the role that your faith played in your decision to take this action. It was very courageous. And, you know, the faith communities throughout the nation had a big role to play in the movements of the 60s.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. John,
that's
for you.
Oh, sure. I am an ordained Methodist minister as well as a scholar. And I brought all those values with me into the South and the Civil Rights Action, and also then into the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam. It would be astonishing for folks today of a certain age to realize how very, very active the churches, the synagogues were in the Civil Rights Movement and also in the anti-war movement. They were the backbone of both movements. So, yes, religion and the strength of religious institutions as institutions of resistance and dissent, that was very important.
Mm. Betty, let me go back to you. And the church committee hearings came a couple of years after the break-in in 1971, looking into some of the abuses by the FBI, government agents. What were the reforms that came out of the church commission hearings?
Well, there were a number of reforms. One very important one was that for the first time, congressional oversight committees were established in both the House and the Senate. And the FISA court was also established. And there was an effort to to create a charter for the FBI that would actually spell out what they could and couldn't do. And that failed. That never was established. But another change that happened, not an enactment by Congress, but the Attorney General at that time, at the time of the Church Committee hearings, was Edward Levy, the former dean of Chicago Law School. And he established the first Attorney General guidelines about FBI behavior. And this was a very significant thing to do. There was debate about it at the time, because the concern was that every new Attorney General would come in and would be able to change those guidelines. And what he finally adopted, were fairly strict, and removing the parts of FBI behavior that had been so offensive. And in fact, that concern was borne out when President Reagan became president, and his first Attorney General did change those guidelines significantly. Mm-hmm. But the fact that those congressional committees existed meant that even when the FBI resorted to some of those old tactics, which it did in the 1980s, the mechanisms were in place, and congressional investigations did take place.
But did the Church Committee hearings, did they determine that what the FBI had been doing, that was actually illegal?
Yes, they definitely did. That some of the actions, they said, you know, were unbelievable that they could take place in a democratic society. And also some of the officials of the FBI gave very strong testimony to the committee, including one who had been number three in the Bureau, William Sullivan, testifying about files that had been written during the time that these actions were taking place, saying that they were illegal, but that was of no concern. Mm. And also agents testified that the legality and ethical value of something did not come into consideration. It was completely a matter of pragmatism.
Let me get John from Coopersburg to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I salute the FBI whistleblowers. And I was a freshman at Swarthmore when you did this. And I want to tell you a quick story. A few months before you raided the office and liberated the files, the FBI raided an off-campus student house at gunpoint in the middle of the night. I mean, it was not at all what a free society is supposed to be. The next morning, one of the students in that house asked for some time in our calculus class to tell them what had happened. Hmm. She was asleep in bed. FBI agents came in at gunpoint looking for something they had no reasonable suspicion to believe was there. I think they thought they were going to find Mao Zedong hiding under a bed or something like that. But that's what they were like, and we knew that. So I salute you for having done this. Thank you.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Bonnie, any kind of response to that particular story? Also what Betty was saying, and I'm curious about when there were the Church Committee hearings, whether you felt, I don't know if you needed to feel vindicated, but whether you felt vindicated.
Well, I think the example that he provided, I had not heard about that at Swarthmore, and it's just very, very shocking. I think any American citizen would be shocked to learn that, not your politics notwithstanding. And these kinds of stories are coming out now. We heard from a gentleman whose father was at George Washington University when Hoover was on the Board of Trustees, and his father was forced out and really lost his entire career.
Betty, did Hoover live long enough to get the reports from the Church Committee hearings?
No. Hoover died in May of 1972. I should say, taking a daily personal interest in the investigation of the media burglary right up until the day he died. And the Church Committee investigations didn't take place until the middle of 1975.
Does it feel?
I would like to
go ahead, Betty.
I'd like to add first a note about Swarthmore. I had not heard that awful story either. Another thing that the files revealed was that every black student at Swarthmore at that time was under FBI surveillance. Right? And the other thing I wanted to say was to make sure that your listeners know that there's a very good documentary on the burglars and what they did called 1971 that will be released later this spring.
Well, that's certainly good to know. Does it feel good, John Raines, to be able to talk so openly about what you did in 1971?
Of course it does. And in part it's because the task of whistleblowers will go on and on and on. Every generation is going to need its version of the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI. Power and privilege will always try to make the big decisions off stage, behind closed doors. We need whistleblowers again and again and again.
I'm going to give you the final word there, Bonnie Raines.
I think that the challenge will continue to be vigilant as citizens who care about our freedoms and who care about threats to other citizens among us. So I think the next generation, and another reason we wanted to have our children understand what we did was so that they can continue that tradition and understand that how important it is to be vigilant and willing to find the truth and bring it out.
Well, Bonnie Raines, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you very much, and John Raines as well.
Thank you.
And Betty Metzger, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called The Burglary, written by our guest, Betty Metzger. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. In fact, you can go to our homepage there and post a comment. You can also get more information about things like podcasts and Twitter and Facebook. I'm Marty Moscowain, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, thank you so much for joining us.